So good morning. This panel on encoding and encoded text is absolutely delighted to welcome three speakers who are also speaking elsewhere on the summer school to come and share their expertise with us. We have in happily alphabetical order, Nicholas Cole, who is a senior researcher at Pembroke College, a senior research fellow at Pembroke College. He's a historian and he's the director of the Quill Project. Those of you who are coming to session 2B tomorrow morning may well find out more about that project with two of his colleagues who will be presenting on it then. Those of you on the introductory strand will also see him later in the week as he comes to share his experience of pedagogy and digital, rather than the research that we'll be talking about more this morning. Barbara McGillivray, whose PhD was from PISA, and she spent some time in Oxford with us, and is now a research fellow at the Alan Turing Institute, which is the National Data Science Centre, and the University of Cambridge. Barbara is, so both of these lovely people are running other workshop strands, sorry, other workshop strands, other than mine, I suppose, I mean, are running one of the eight workshop strands on the summer school, and we're enormously grateful that they're putting in this extra time as well. So Barbara's strand is from text to tech, and she's a computational linguist. And this is Megan Sensony, from the iSchool at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She is a long-standing friend of the summer school and collaborator on several projects based at Oxford. And is her specialism is data curation. The strand that she is running, or helping run, is humanities data, a hands-on approach. So it's the data curation strand of the summer school. The reason that I'm here, possibly chairing it, is my history in the text encoding initiative. It was that I've been working in it since about 2000, by which I mean using it to edit texts. And it was that that brought me to Oxford in the first place. I'm currently on the board of directors, the elected board of directors, serving as secretary. And the suggestion for this panel came from Nicholas, who found that the text encoding initiative, the TEI, was entirely unsuitable for what he wanted to do. So he suggested that he come and explain to us why the text encoding initiative is entirely unsuitable. And we thought that was a very interesting point to discuss, but could also benefit from many different views. So for those of you who don't know, Oxford has a long history, a long connection with the text encoding initiative. Since the 1980s, people here, primarily in the Oxford University Computing Services, which has since changed its name and become IT Services, they've been engaged with it, particularly Lou Bernard. When Sebastian Ratz joined the university, he became hugely engaged with it, and both of them have worked doing astonishing amounts of work behind the scenes for that project, for that consortium. The TEI, which, forgive us if we call it that, we're so familiar with it, and it's quite a mouthful to say the Text Encoding Initiative, let alone to add consortium at the end. It's three things. It is most importantly the community that uses it, it's a governance structure, and it's the guidelines. This is what most people assume that it is. It's the guidelines for encoding texts in a particular flavor, if you like, of XML, so that they're good for interchange and interoperability. There is a whole strand, as you may know, some of you may be on it, of the summer school that teaches it. And in fact, the whole summer school grew out of the Text Encoding Initiative summer school. So we are all here, thanks to Oxford's long history with it. I believe that the biggest project ever undertaken in the TEI was early English Books Online Text Creation Partnership, so the DCP, which is led by the University of Michigan with Oxford and the Bodleian Library as the lead UK partner. And that project has produced 60 or 70,000 texts, full transcribed and lightly marked up texts from the early modern period. And that has been based at the Bodleian for 15 years. I worked on it. Judith, who knew some of you on my strand, Judith Seifring, met yesterday, has also worked on it. And I think that's probably about as much as we want to say about the TEI, which is already quite a lot. So this is the panel where we get to talk about other ways of encoding text. If you want to bring the TEI back into the conversation when we open up discussion to the floor, please do. We have, at the very least, one world expert sitting in the front row, who... Sorry, James is pointing out he's sitting in the second row.
Offset,
Aaron. My co-director, James Cummings, is on the technical council, so the people who do the actual work of the TEI, and has been for years. He chaired the technical council for some time as well, and is leading the TEI strand. So feel free to bring that back in, but this panel, we have three complete experts in text who are immersed in it, and that's what they do. And they don't use TEI. So, Nicholas, may I ask you to tell us what you do? Tell us about your life in text.
So my life in text. So I feel a bit dropped into this by this introduction. I work on, or one set of texts that I work on are the records of the 1787 Constitutional Convention. And there isn't a good digital edition of those texts. So... that is something that somebody ought to do. But producing just an edition was not what we really wanted to do. What the project that I run does is create a model of negotiations. So we wanted to take the records of this 3-month-long process of negotiation that produces the American Constitution, and we wanted to produce a model of those negotiations. What we wanted to do with that was take each formal proposal to change the text in front of the convention, each suggested amendment, and each vote, and be able to display for researchers a reconstruction of the paperwork in front of members of the convention for each process of debate. So we told the computer how parliamentary processes work, and we needed to encode the proposals for amendment, and often amendments of amendments of amendments. I think they go to about 6 levels deep because they're that pedantic. And all of the votes, and we needed the computer to be able to say, okay, well, for this moment in debate, this is what the text in front of everybody looked like. So that was what we set out to do. And we also hoped, as a sort of ancillary project, to then tidy up a digital edition of the manuscript. And we haven't done that bit of the project yet at all. We've worked off older and less perfect editions in order to create the current model that's online. So if you go to our website right now, what you see is based on a 1911 edition of the manuscripts that are available. And the manuscripts are difficult and problematic in all kinds of ways. But the place where TEI comes in, or doesn't come in, is that one way we could have done this is to create some kind of layered document that we could have encoded with PEI that would have let you sort of navigate through the convention. The problem with that was we would have spent an awful lot of time building that platform. It would have been completely bespoke and linked to those records. So we could never have done what we hope to do in the next phase of the project, which is to start to compare different negotiated processes. And we would have spent years marking up the text just to work for one negotiation, and what we wanted was a much more generic platform. And then the second problem we hit was a technical one, which is that if you're going to create a reconstruction of text, you need to be able to merge various snippets of text into documents, and you need to do that with quite a degree of tolerance in the algorithms that you're using. And we use, at the very base of what we do, Google's diff match patch algorithm, which some of you may be familiar with. Google always hate it when I say it came out of their Wave project, because they like to forget that Wave existed. But Wave actually solved a very similar problem, which was changes to text arriving in a non-determined order. And if you think about a parliamentary process of negotiation where you might have an amendment and then a vote on amendments, but not necessarily in the order in which they were first proposed, it's actually a very analogous problem. So it turned out that algorithm had all of the kinds of tolerances that we needed. There's just one problem with it. It doesn't work with XML. So there was, and we went looking for a long, long time. I spent about 3 months looking for an algorithm we could use with an XML document that would have the features that we needed to make the model of the parliamentary process work. And there isn't currently one that exists with the right tolerances. So we therefore took the decision that we wouldn't use TEI. So that's why our project doesn't use TEI at its core. But it does lead us to reflect on one other thing, which is that we saved an awful lot of time, and we were able to build an interface that historians who had no technical background were able to use to put our data into our platform very, very quickly, and much more quickly than if we'd been training them in markup first and then getting them to do the data entry. So that's where the sort of wider conversation goes, I think. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nicholas. Barbara, tell us about your text.
So my texts are Latin texts. So I'm a linguist and I'm interested in linguistic information in texts. So when I started working on these texts, I resorted to linguistic corpora, and they had nothing to do with TI. So they were built with the purpose of investigating linguistic phenomena. So they had information about the morphological inflections of words, or going from eating to eat, and crucially, syntactic information, something that people spend a long time doing. So reconstructing the analysis of each sentence in a text. So identifying the subject, the object, the predicate, attributes, and so on. And that was the main source of data for my analysis. So I was interested in how verbs behaved in Latin over time, and I basically just grabbed what was available. I didn't have time to build my own corpus at the time, and there were three different projects that had built Latin corpora and that collaborated, so they agreed on a set of guidelines. So that was very good because it meant that I could compare classical Latin with medieval Latin, so they had the same, they were annotated in the same way. But there was big limitation, so there was very, very little metadata. So basically all I could find out was the author, the text, and then what they wrote. So for this verb study, that was enough. But going forward, I'm planning to research semantic change, so how words change meaning over time. And for that, I will not be able to use the linguistic corpora alone, because I need a whole range of contextual information that these corpora lack. And it's one point I made in a book that is forthcoming with OUP. It's going to be published in October.
What's it called?
It's called Quantitative Historical Linguistics, a Corpus Framework. So watch out for it in October.
In all good bookshops.
In all the good bookshops. yes, and I make this point that the linguistic community hasn't really engaged enough with the encoding community to provide resources that have rich enough metadata. And also in the field of meaning change, computational linguists have developed very fancy algorithms to track and model meaning change, but they've actually not considered contextual features at all. So there is a big gap between the old-fashioned way of investigating meaning change, where close reading and full account of the history and the geography and the style of the author and the period and the world knowledge at the time, and the computational community where just linguistic data is used. So my plan is to have the two talk to each other. So in fact, I'm waiting to hear from about a project that I've submitted at the Turing, which involves a collaboration between classical scholars and computational linguists to work together to incorporate this contextual information in the text. And then I can just mention my experience at the Oxford Dictionaries, where the Oxford dictionaries are encoded in XML, but they don't follow TI, even though I know, I'm aware that TI has a dictionary strand, but they developed their own DTD, and the Oxford English Dictionary has a different DTD from the current dictionaries, have a different DTD from the bilingual dictionaries. And I spent quite a lot of time when I was there trying to harmonize all these resources. So,
So the dictionaries you're talking about are the dictionaries published by OUP, Oxford University Press.
Yes.
Thank you. Could you tell us what a DTD is?
Terms? So the DTD explains the structure of the document for the XML. So it says what are the items in this case in the dictionary, how different sub-elements relate to the parent element. So you have, say, dictionary entry, and within the dictionary entry you have information about the word itself and the examples and the definition, and it gets very complex. In fact, you could imagine how complex it can get, but
so a sort of rule book for this document and how you use the XML in it.
Exactly. And it was built for human users, so when I tried to access this data programmatically, I ran into challenges. But it was a very interesting experience, and it made me think how much we need a standardized approach and having resources talk to each other more explicitly.
Thank you very much. Megan, what do you do with text?
So aside from having organized workshops for our graduate students on TEI, I'm very far removed from the text encoding initiative. Somewhere deep in a folder hierarchy on my desktop, I have a toy project that I was very interested in working with to think about a parallel text edition of English and French representations of La Prose du Transsibérien. And for the most part, for me, that seems like the prototypical kind of use case is making editions of texts, exploring different modes of representation, and then thinking critically about the structure and semantics, but often at a kind of close range, in my experience. So within my own professional responsibilities and personal research, that's a bit far removed from what I've been doing. Until recently, I've worked as a project coordinator for the HathiTrust Research Center. How many of you have heard Stephen talk as of yet? Or
No, not yet. The introductory stretch.
Okay, so I'll briefly describe it. This is the research arm of the HathiTrust Digital Library, and the HathiTrust Digital Library is a large-scale corpus of, at this point, more than 15 million digitized volumes. And they've been collected through the Google Books Digitization Initiative and then a number of different partners, university partners in the HathiTrust Consortium who have been digitizing their own library collections. The overarching mission of our center is to create a secure computational environment for exploring these texts without violating A, copyright laws, and B, licensing agreements. So these data are text files, and they are derived from digitized images using optical character recognition. The files themselves are really, really messy. And in fact, I would say the files are as far from a lovingly, beautifully curated TEI project as I can possibly imagine. But when you're running these kinds of algorithms over large bodies of text, the biggest problems, the primary interests, are in trying to clean up OCR errors and also developing workflows for stripping out what might be considered extraneous data. So depending on your purposes, this can include headers and footers, page numbers, and honestly, even the semantic and structural encoding that makes TEI so powerful in other contexts. It's no secret, I hope, that a lot of scholars will take TEI text and discard everything in the angle brackets as a standard step in their data processing workflows to do probabilistic and statistical analysis. So that's one project that I've been working on and involved in that takes a completely different approach from TEI. There's another project that I wanted to just bring up that I've been working on called Publishing Without Walls. And here I've been working with scholars in the humanities to incubate engagement with a suite of common digital publishing tools that you're probably already familiar with, things like Scalar, Omeka, Pressbooks. And none of these play that nicely with TEI XML files, but nor does our designated community in this project overlap with the folks in the TEI consortium. For the most part, what we're interested in this project is helping scholars produce original long-form research as open access digital monographs. So, you know, original texts that are coming into being through scholarly research and work. Maybe one day they'll be the source material for a lovingly encoded critical edition, but that's really not the primary objective. My research on that project, and also through the HathiTrust Research Center, has been studying interdisciplinary, collaborative, and curatorial research practices of the scholars who are doing this work. So for both the HTRC and Publishing Without Walls, what I essentially do is design and implement studies of user needs and do, trying to think of what some of the studies have been. So we did one study on how users go about building their research collections and corpora. We did another study of how users are conducting text data mining and other forms of computational analysis on their texts. And we've done studies of how people are managing their kind of distributed, multi-institutional collaborations for humanities research projects. These take the form of surveys, focus groups, interviews, which are then either exported or transcribed into text files. And using grounded theory approaches to qualitative data analysis, my collaborators and I work directly with the texts to develop a codebook of key concepts that come out of the interviews and focus groups. We then use tools like Invivo and Atlas TI to systematically assign these codes to portions of the text and conduct thematic analysis on the excerpts that converge around each code. So coming from the social sciences, this is a really common approach to working with text data. It's also proven to be a fruitful strategy for historians and other humanists. One example that I particularly like that came out of one of my interviews was a historian using content analysis on letters and diaries from 18th century texts and trying to draw out themes using these kinds of social science qualitative approaches. So for me, I think the rich kind of methodological diversity of DH means that we have multiple tools in our arsenal and we can benefit from a certain disciplinary fluidity, drawing both from qualitative and quantitative approaches from the social sciences to do our interpretive work as humanists. Moreover, as researchers, we are creating our own texts, and the DH community has provided some tremendously useful tools to make our own scholarship open and accessible, with minimal encoding on our part, which I think is a good thing, because sometimes we just want to get our work out there. And one of these days, I swear, I will get back to my TEI project. But this is a lot to be doing for now.
Yes, it absolutely is. And the idea of this was not to bring everyone round to the one true path, which is TEI. It's to celebrate the diversity of the work that's done, and we have no sonic screwdriver for text, apart maybe from plain text, you know, an absolutely basic text editor. Every project, whatever it is, selects the tools that are most useful for it. It's not one size fits all. That rather than why aren't you using TEI, Megan? was meant to be the spirit of the discussion. May I ask you all a question about the preservation of your texts? Because I know that the HathiTrust, the whole idea of it was set up to preserve texts. But you were all involved in at least curating and in some cases either turning something digital, sort of digitizing the text of it that wasn't originally, I think in the case of some of the editions that you're working with, certainly your source material, or taking other people's corpora and turning. So what do you do about preserving the long-term preservation of your texts?
So I do get asked every single talk I do on our project, every time I do a talk, wherever it is in the world, I'm pleased to say the influence of TEI is everywhere, every single time I do a talk, somebody says, why aren't you using TEI? And often what they follow it up with, but if you're not using TEI, what about data preservation? You know, so that is the question that I have been most asked about our project, is that. And it's a really, really, really good question. So, you know, the best we can do, we have a custom database, it is documented really well. You know, in the event of nuclear war, if anybody, you know, finds just our database but not our user interface, they could probably reconstruct our data from the documentation if that has survived too. All I would say about this is I'm not sure that TEI is a good first step in data preservation, but every single project that uses TEI, even if it's on very similar material, uses it in slightly different ways. So I'm not, I don't feel too guilty, because I think every project that uses TEI would also have to preserve its own documentation for, and this is what we meant when we used these labels in this way. And I think that's very analogous to what we've had to do, which is back up our database and document what all the fields are, and tell you how to process them to get the output you want. And I'm not sure that that's so different, actually, from a TEI approach. I mean, there are lots of different front ends to TEI encoded projects, but my sense is they all have to be customized a bit to the specific way in which TEI has been used for a particular data set. So, you know, I think like every TEI project, we document what we did, we've backed it up as best as we can. We will eventually be talking to, you know, the various preservation services about how, you know, when we've got a very stable format, you know, how to put it in there. But I think that's very analogous to what any project would have to do, whatever kind of encoding it's using. You can see I'm sort of practiced at that. Answer, but
very neat. I'm also looking forward to the outreach program to cockroaches, because this is all very well that your data is going to survive the nuclear apocalypse, but we won't.
Well, there's an interesting point there, which came out in one discussion we had, which is a lot of the innovation that we've had to do is in our user interface, and I think there's a presumption in a lot of digital humanities communities that the important thing to preserve is just the data, and that the front end doesn't matter very much, or matters less, or it will be superseded by something else. That's not been our experience with our data set. The way we've stored the data and the innovations we've had to use in terms of the presentation, and also the data entry really go hand in hand. And so, in a way, just to preserve our data set and not preserve what we think about the user interface,